So most people believe this is a new decade. Apparently, even that can't be agreed upon by everyone. But I like to think this is a new decade. And new decades are times to pause and think a bit about what you're doing. And for someone like me who's worked in cosmology for a long time, I think it can be quite helpful to pause and look back and try and understand how we've reached the point that we're at. Because cosmology is a mad flurry of activity and high-performance computing and new observations and dozens of archive papers every day. And sometimes you can lose sight of why you're doing it and what your long-term motivation really is. And I find that in such a circumstance, it can be helpful to also look backwards and try and see what you can learn from going backwards up to the present that you can extrapolate into the future. Also as a way of trying to remind yourself why you're doing things. This may be partly for my benefit rather than yours, but luckily I'm the speaker, so I can say whatever I like for my benefit and you're there listening to it. But I hope I have some messages and viewpoints that you'll find interesting or possibly provocative. So let's see. Because I decided to talk with a little bit of a historical perspective, and this is some of the history of things I've seen during my career as cosmology, as a cosmologist coming in, the very first thing that I stopped to think about was what it used to be like doing cosmology. And I'm going to sound like some kind of archaic relic of the Victorian era in what I say, because almost everyone in this room is much younger, and usually much, much younger than I am, and can't quite believe that the world wasn't always the way it was. So I started thinking, well, what was different about how we did cosmology when I started my career? And I very rapidly shocked even myself in remembering all the things that didn't exist when I started as a cosmologist. Here are things that didn't exist that all affect the way you do cosmology today. Mobile phones, for example, didn't exist. And I don't mean smartphones, iPhones, etc. Mobile phones, full stop, didn't exist. Laptops didn't exist. I remember I was several years a postdoc before I got my first ever laptop. Data projectors didn't exist. Wi-Fi didn't exist. The World Wide Web didn't exist. No Google, no Amazon, no Facebook. The archive also didn't exist. It kind of predated the web because it appeared in a mailing list form first before the web art interface you're familiar with. But that didn't exist either. LaTeX didn't exist. I wrote my thesis on Mac Word on a cubic Mac that would belong in a museum these days. Well, it would still work, mind you. PDF didn't exist. I'm always surprised that PDF didn't really exist until the very end of the 1990s as a format. We now spend all our time sending around PDFs right, left, and center, but it's a relatively recent format. The way we work has changed immeasurably. No Skype, no Dropbox, Zoom, Slack, GitHub, Google, none of these collaboration tools that we all spend several hours each day, especially if you're in any kind of collaborative team, you spend all your time using these things, which are hopefully improving your efficiency, but they're mostly doing that by vastly increasing the amount of work that you can do and therefore are expected to do. So that's not always in your best interest that these things exist.
Andrew, I wrote my thesis in LaTeX.
You did. To be fair, it did exist. It was not in widespread use. Maybe it hadn't made it across the Scottish border. So when I moved to Sussex, I did encounter LaTeX for the first time. But we had no computers capable of running it in Glasgow when I was a PhD student. Software, we all spend our time running software. There was no public cosmology software of any sort. If you wanted to calculate anything, something as simple as an angular diameter distance, you had to write a piece of code yourself in order to do it. No parallel computing. And of course, there was no data of any note either. There was no cosmic microwave background anisotropies, no high redshift supernovae, no weak gravitational waves. None of that stuff existed. So when I think back, I'm actually bewildered that any of us managed to achieve anything at all during these eras. And I invite you to look at these boxes. There's five boxes. And think, if you had to give up just one of these boxes, which one would you choose? And how would it affect the way you work today? Now have a look. Which one? I know which one I would choose. Yeah, I think it's probably between the top right and the bottom left. I would ditch this one because I never do any computing anyway. But imagine you had to ditch all five of them. Essentially, everything you do every day becomes impossible. So cosmology has changed a considerable amount during that time. What else didn't exist? Perimeter Institute didn't exist, but has, of course, radically changed the existence of all of us by providing this amazing environment. And it's been a great privilege for us to be here for this last year. I think our time is probably ticking, but we're clinging on with our fingertips for as long as we can. So we'll see how we do. So those things all didn't exist. But one thing that did interest me in this list was that by the end of the 1990s, almost all of these things did exist. So if you are a young person who only really remembers the 2000s, and I can see a whole bunch of you who are in that category, the 2000s have actually not seen such radical changes. The year 2000 is not very different from 2020 in terms of what you can do and how you would do it. 2000 was much, much more different from 1990. The 1990s were the great decade of innovation in the way we all work. And also, as it happens, coincidentally, in cosmology, we're also the decade where all of the key observations came to fruition as well, and more or less wrote the story for us. So that's a bit of history that now makes you all think that I must be at least 90 years old. I'm not quite, but on the way. So roughly, then, I've set a time span of 30 years of cosmology, and the long arc of cosmology, I guess my title, is to try and take the long view of where cosmology has been going. And these 30 years, which more or less correspond to my active awareness of existence as a cosmologist, have been absolutely dominated by the cosmic microwave background in terms of what most of us do. And I'm talking here about cosmology, I'm really talking about learning about the fundamental nature of the universe, not the things in it. There's, of course, been enormous developments in understanding galaxies, how they form and evolve, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just not talking about that particular kind of thing. I'm talking about cosmology, the properties of the universe as a whole. It's all been about the cosmic microwave background, fueled by these three generations of satellites coming along roughly once per decade, which changed the way that we saw the universe. Starting with the COBE satellite, which made the first measurement of the cosmic microwave background anisotropies, and the results are in 1992. In this column, I've just focused on the results that I think are the key results from these missions. They all made several different releases. 1992 was the first COBE release from the DMR experiment that measured the anisotropies. They also had the fantastic result from the FIRAS experiment in 1990 that measured the temperature of the CMB, which has not been beaten yet, more than 30 years later, that remains the best measurement of the CMB temperature. And they had a later data release, which was the sort of final collection of data. But the landmark moment was clearly 1992. WMAP, its key impact was 2003, because it established precision cosmology. The day they published the results was the day everyone stopped talking about, oh, we don't really know what this value is and this value is, and started saying, here's a bunch of six parameters that let us explain everything we seem to see in cosmology. The 2006 release was the second release of the three-year data set, and it was a significantly better analyzed release. It obviously wasn't so hurried as the first one, and so it was a very, very powerful release in its own right. The later ones for WMAP were much more incremental. Then a decade on again, there's Planck, which I worked on for a few years, launched in 2009. Its first results came out in 2013, but probably here the key result is 2018 release called the Legacy release of data from the Planck satellite, because it is potentially the last word on at least the temperature anisotropies of the CMB, because at this point the temperature has been more or less measured as well as it is possible to measure it. So close to the cosmic variance limit across a very wide range of scales. And so it is bringing to the end this 30-year arc of cosmic microwave background being the dominant driver of our understanding of cosmology. Coming into the next decade, we can expect to see the CMB to some extent supplanted by surveys such as large galaxy surveys or radio 21-centimeter surveys, that are able to probe the whole three-dimensional structure of the universe rather than the two-dimensional sphere that the cosmic microwave background comes from. But cosmic microwave background will continue, particularly with the polarization of the cosmic microwave background being where all of the activity is going to be over the coming decade or so. I don't think it will ever be in as dominant a position as the temperature anisotropies have been throughout this period, but it will certainly be a very important player for some time to come, and it's very hard to imagine ever trying to compare a cosmological model to data that's not going to use the CMB temperature anisotropies, more or less in the form of the Planck final legacy release, or perhaps some future refined analysis by the collaboration or by others. So I should also say that if you've got fantastic observations, they're only useful as long as you have the theory and the tools in place to exploit them. So as well as the key observational developments, there had to be developments in theory and in analysis that enable that data to be used to its full power. And there's huge numbers of people have contributed here, but I would put in just a couple of special mentions. One is the development of the CMB fast code by Celjak and Zaldarriaga in 1996, which was the first publicly available efficient code that actually computed what was expected in the cosmic microwave background. Before that, people had to write their own codes, and they jealously guarded them. So there were just a few research groups in the world who had the capability of computing what the CMB looked like, and it would take them hours or days or weeks to produce a single prediction through the inefficient methods available, and they wouldn't let anyone else do it.
So there was this code that CMB FAST is based on
Mann Bertschinger's cosmic code.
It was publicly available, but it didn't
do the fast computation through the line of sight method. That's right. I think it was public in a certain sense. It was public. Yeah. It was, at least for a while, it was public to people who were friends of. You could run it then. Okay. So that's also important. And you should say, CMB FAST is indeed built upon that earlier code from a couple of years before. The other one is an analysis where I think the landmark was the production of the COSMO-MC code by Lewis and Bridle in 2002, which is still largely used in the community today to carry out the statistical analysis, comparing the models to the data. And that built on a whole pile of innovations, mostly outside cosmology, but also Lloyd Knox and collaborators were involved in early introduction of Monte Carlo methods into cosmology as a very effective way of constraining models. So that's how the CMB looks. Lee had a question, I think.
Yeah, Jakey, the actual discovery of the CMB, I remember it was
62 or 65.
Why did it take so long from there to the measurement of the anisotropies?
Only that they are very, very small, so being 1 part in 10 to the 5. And in particular, it's very hard to do from the ground because of substantial microwave emission from the atmosphere. And I think for a long time in the 1980s, particularly, there would be intermittent claims of detection of the CMB anisotropies that always turned out to be atmospheric artifacts, not adequately subtracted. It was only really by going into space it became possible to detect them. I could mention in passing, COBE were very lucky because prevailing wisdom at the time would have put the level of the anisotropies roughly a factor of 2 below what was eventually observed. Because at the time, almost everyone believed in a critical density universe, which predicts roughly half the level of anisotropies of the lambda CDM model that now turns out to be correct. So had prevailing wisdom been right, in fact, COBE would probably not have had the sensitivity to make a detection. It's an interesting little wrinkle. Okay, I'd better push on and have a look at the clock to remind myself. So where did all this end up? Well, 6-parameter cosmological model is what everyone talks about, though I will have to tell you quite a bit about what the 6 is supposed to be and what it means. But the kind of data we're talking about is this. This is the Planck 2018 power spectrum. So these are some BINS data points here with minuscule error bars. This point. Down here, there's a blow up where of the residual against the best fit theoretical model. Up to here, the range has been shrunk by a factor of about 5, I think. But from here onwards, it's this numerical scale. It's a further factor of 10 expansion of the axis. So I think it's a factor of something like 50 in total of this panel against this, just to be able to let you see these tiny error bars. And cosmologists tend to be a bit blasé about this because figures like this have been around since the first WMAP result. But I always like to mention that this is the most extraordinary graph you will ever see. And I still think it's extraordinary when I see it today after almost 20 years. Because the theoretical prediction, the wiggly line that underpins this, was produced at a time when there was zero data. In fact, it was produced in the 1970s. Peebles and Yu in the West, Sakharov at some inputs in the right. It was already computed fairly accurately in the mid-1980s by people like Bond and here in Canada and Evstathiou. Now, it's a several parameter fit. You have to fit these six parameters to the data, but there's far more data points than six parameters worth in this curve. And yet the points are all almost perfectly on the line. I'm sure nowhere in cosmology, I bet nowhere in astronomy, and possibly nowhere in physics, has a prediction of such complicated level been made at a time when there was no data whatsoever and subsequently been shown to match the data to precision of this order. I may be wrong, but no one's ever come to me at the end of a seminar and said, no, actually, some magnetic resonance, blah, 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 was measured like this. Lee is about to tell me, though.
No, it's worth mentioning it was not the only prediction. Many people were shocked when the first peak came to.
There were other possibilities at the time. This is based on an inflationary paradigm, and there were other possibilities for and requires cold, dark matter in order to get the peak structure at all. It could certainly have looked very different, but standard ideas of cold, dark matter models that have been around since the 80s predicted that the Earth would look like this. I just think it's remarkable, so it's worth pausing for a little bit to remember how remarkable this is, because it's part of the wallpaper if you're a cosmologist and you tend to forget how special things like that are. I'm trying to say a lot of things which are more general in cosmology, because I can see many people in the audience who are not cosmologists, but sometimes I say things which are fairly specialized. For example, these are the actual six parameters being measured with their uncertainties, and I haven't said what any of them are yet. But all I want to do is draw your attention to the fact that typically the error bars on these parameters in the model are something like 1%. So this is the density of cold dark matter in the universe with a 1% error bar. This is the density of baryons in the universe with that kind of 0.2% error bar. So the measurements within the six parameter model are extraordinarily precise. In fact, for all of the parameters, not all as good as that. So that's where we landed. Now, I want to step back a little bit and everyone mutters, oh yeah, there's a six parameter model of cosmology. What do they mean by that? And why did they decide it was six parameters? And what are they doing? And so I want to give a bit of orientation around that. Now, the first thing is, I should say something that is probably obvious to everyone who's a physicist, what actually is a model. If you're given a pile of data, your model is your attempt to explain it. And your model's usually a bunch of mathematics that you're going to implement probably on a computer, but maybe with a piece of paper. And that bit of mathematics is supposed to reproduce the numerics of the data that you've produced. John.
Did you show omega lambda? The time energy is important in fitting.
I didn't there, but I will.
You can't fit it.
Yes, it's included. Yeah. So these were spatially flat models. So the lambda is a derived parameter from the other parameters. I didn't show it there, but I'll show it in a little bit. But just now, I want to go back to a level of abstraction. We're trying to explain some data. The data is a pile of numbers. So our model to fit it is something which is going to produce a pile of numbers. How do you get a pile of numbers? You think of some physics, which gives you some equations. You solve the equations tell you what the numbers are. And the idea that we all have in physics, particularly particle physics or other branches of fundamental physics, is that we're supposed to have some principles or ideas in mind, or symmetries, dualities, other things like that, that guide us and restrict the way in which we can set up our mathematical model. But usually when you set up your model, it's not perfectly specified. There's usually a bunch of things which are left undetermined. For example, in Newton's theory of gravity, everything's there except that the actual strength of gravity, the constant g, is undetermined. All you can do is go and try to measure it and find out what the value of g is for your universe. The speed of light in some units is the same. And in cosmology, it's like that as well. From first principles at the moment, we don't have any way of determining things like what the present expansion rate of the universe is or what the densities of the different material constituents are. So we finish up with these undetermined quantities we call parameters, and those are things which are then fit from the data. And that's the thing that we're going to have six of in the standard cosmological model. So there's a bunch of different things going on here, because some properties are going to be assumed, some properties are maybe going to be tested against the data, and some parameters are going to be measured from the data without us having necessarily any good idea in advance what the values are. Now, if I talk about a model, a model's not the parameters. A model is a choice of a set of parameters. And almost always questions about models are much more interested in questions about parameters. Because at root, who really cares what the expansion rate of the universe is? You know, it's nice to have some vague idea of what it is, but I'm not very interested in its precise value. As long as I think the universe is expanding, I'm fairly happy with that. But the choice of the set of parameters is important, because the set of parameters is telling you what physical processes you need to use to explain your data. And it's telling you whether you have sufficient understanding of the problem that you have actually included all the necessary physics relevant to the observations you've got, or whether you're missing something, you have to add in new physics, which will probably bring new parameters, which you then have to fit from the data. So model-level questions tend to be more interesting, because they're the questions that are about physics rather than about numerology. It's not always true, but in broad terms, I'd be willing to defend that statement. So our starting point in any branch of physics is normally we don't really know what the model is. The whole point of doing cosmology is we don't understand the universe, and we want to find out what is the physics relevant to the universe. And we hope there's lots of it. The more stuff there is going on, the better, the more effort we can put into learning about fundamental physics or how astronomy works or about the structure of the universe as a whole. So we've got different choices for these models, and we don't know what physics we're going to throw in, but we're going to have to find some way of deciding which physics is relevant and which is not. So the goal typically is to try and find the simplest model that can explain the data, which means just removing extraneous parameters, things you thought might have been relevant but turn out not to be relevant to the description of the universe. For example, once upon a time, people thought that the universe was filled, it might be filled with cosmic strings, which are kind of line-like defects that might stir up the plasma and create density perturbations. So it might include that in their fit. But nowadays, people by and large don't think that that's the case, and they eliminate parameters connected to cosmic strings and don't include them. So that's all well and good, but as I'll come back to later in the talk, simplest can mean different things to different people. And we're going to have to be more careful and precise in order to really decide what's meant by simplest and what is the best ways to try and decide criteria for what gives us a simple description of the universe. So how does this look in cosmology? I think cosmological parameters became a serious topic of interest around the year 2000. It happened right at the end of the 1990s. Within the space of about 1 week, two senior British cosmologists both released popular textbooks which were on cosmological parameters. So that gives us some orientation for what we might be talking about. The second one of these was by Martin Rees, who was here very recently giving a public talk here, who wrote a book called Just Six Numbers, where he extracted six parameters he thought were interesting things we wanted to know about the universe. And so these were the sorts of things he was talking about. Fine structure constant, ratio of fundamental strengths, the total density of matter in the universe and of the cosmological constant in the universe, the amplitude of density perturbations that cause structures to form in the universe, and the spatial dimensions of the universe. Those were the six things that he made in his book. Now, a week before, Michael Rowan Robinson at Imperial College, who was actually my boss at the time because I was working there, produced a book called The Nine Numbers of the Cosmos. So he's three numbers smarter than Martin Rees, which is really quite something. And his book instead produced this list of possible parameters. He broke up the densities of individual material constituents, baryons, cold dark matter, and hot dark matter. At the time, it was quite fashionable to think there might be two kinds of dark matter in the universe. Also, the cosmological constant, age and expansion rate, temperature of the microwave background, the amplitude, again, as was up there, and the star formation history of the universe. Anyone who's scratching their head and wondering how the star formation history of the universe could be a parameter only needs to know that the main topic of research of Michael Rowan Robinson is the star formation history of the universe, and then they will understand.
I don't think I understand.
Then you should buy the book, which is still available on Amazon. In fact, I think maybe only for $1. So these were his nine numbers. Martin Rees did his six numbers, and they're both clearly just thinking of numbers they like the sound of. There's not very good agreement between the two lists, either in length or in content. So that's all very vague and mostly down to personal prejudice. We're scientists, so we well, we love personal prejudice, of course. I'm not going to say we don't like it. We love personal prejudice, but we should be trying to act against it as much as we can. So I'm going to write down something which is a little bit more strict. I was thinking about this. I've not seen this written down exactly in these words before. This is was me writing it down, trying to figure out what I should be saying for this talk. And I decided this would be a modern version. The parameters are the interesting subset of those quantities varied in the likelihood of the simplest model capable of fitting the data being considered. That takes a bit of digesting. I started with like 10 words, and then I just thought, well, this isn't precise enough. I'm going to add more words, more words, more words. Interesting subset, I think, is a good pair of words to put up there. Now, the fundamental tool of a cosmologist is a likelihood function. Likelihood function tells you how well the data fits your model prediction. And one of the most fantastic innovations in cosmology, which I think WMAP pioneered, was that the observational teams felt an obligation to release a likelihood function as part of the data products of their project. And those likelihood functions could immediately be plugged into analysis and made it possible for everyone to use their data very, very easily. And that's a fantastic thing. So the likelihood function is the tool that lets you ask the question, you know, I'm interested in these parameters with these values. How probable is the data given those values of the parameters? And you plug that into some statistical analysis package and get your answer. And that's great. However, it turns out that actually the number of parameters in a typical likelihood function can be quite large because there's a whole pile of modeling that goes into any data that you don't want to think about. For example, in the cosmic microwave background, sure, there's the cosmic microwave background, which is great, but if you just look at microwaves in the sky, there's all sorts of other stuff. There's what we call foreground contamination coming from our galaxy, from other distant galaxies. It can be synchrotron emission, it can be free. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there, and then there's uncertainties about exactly the shape of the telescope beam and so on and so on. And all of these things are modeled in the data. So the likelihood function contains a whole pile of parameters which we call nuisance parameters, which contain that modeling. And in the end, we're not very interested in them, so we like to pretend that they're not there, or rather we marginalize over them, which is to say we're averaging over that uncertainty. And the interesting subset of quantities here means the ones you've decided not to marginalize over. And more or less, you're choosing the interesting subset. I should say, one of the lasting charms for me of being in the Planck satellite collaboration was this enormous collection of French astronomers who were really, really interested in the dust in the Milky Way galaxy and saw the cosmic microwave background as this really, really irritating interference that they wanted to marginalize away. So absolutely everyone cannot agree what are nuisance parameters and what are interesting parameters. So there's still some level of subjectivity. But anyway, some subset is going to be chosen. And then simplest, I'll be saying a bit more about later on, what criteria can we use to produce the simplest model within which we will have our interesting subset of quantities, the ones that we're really looking for. So this is what I mean by parameters. And usually there'll be some minimal set that's required to explain whatever observations are there. So if I jump back a slide or two to, too far, to these guys, I would have to say that the Michael Rowan Robinson list bears much more resemblance to what I would be thinking about now than does the Martin Rees. I've never, for example, been aware of anyone thinking they ought to vary the number of spatial dimensions in an actual fits to data. No one thought, oh, there's the Planck satellite data. I'd better allow the number of spatial dimensions to be 3, 4, 5, or 6 and figure out the likelihood of it.
There was a paper by Stefan Alexander and David Sprecher that fit the LIGO data with variable dimension of the space.
See, yeah, for the CMB, that's true. Yes, for other properties, it's not so obvious. I'm being a bit cosmocentric, I think, in what I'm saying. Equally, there are some things that you might think are so well measured that they're not really relevant to fitting. So the fine structure constant, sure, it's a great number, a fundamental property of the universe, but it's really, really, really well measured. No one thinks that they have to measure that from the cosmic microwave background. They're just going to plug in 1/137 into their Thomson cross-section and follow things through from there. So it's not really a parameter, but this list here that Michael Rowan Robinson has is a pretty good list of things that we don't know that we might want to learn, particularly the densities of the different materials. He has overkilled it a bit because he's got too many parameters. Some of these actually depend on other ones, unless you are very generous in your in the generality of the cosmological model you're taking. And also things like the temperature of the microwave background is independently very well measured by FIRAS, as I've already mentioned, and no one tries to measure the temperature of the microwave background from the kinds of data sets we're fitting in cosmology to measure other parameters. But more or less, that's the kind of list. And a slightly pruned version of Michael Rowan Robinson's list is the six parameters which are used to fit WMAP or Planck data. So what are these actual parameters? Here they are. This is cosmological parameters 2020. I'm going to point with a hockey stick here. So these are them in words. You can choose different combinations of these parameters. There's not a single way of parameterizing the standard model, but in this version, the universe is assumed to be spatially flat, which determines the dark energy density as a consequence of the values of the other density parameters that are going to actually be measured in the fit. So the cosmological constant is absolutely in the fit, but it's not a variable parameter in the fit because it's fixed by assumption of spatial flatness. So these are the kind of things we want to measure. And you saw the list of numbers given earlier on, but just to give it in percentages, these are the percentage accuracies with which things are measured these days in cosmology. The most accessible things are the expansion rate and the different densities, baryonic-cooled dark matter, measured very accurately. The optical depth measures the amount of scattering that cosmic microwave background photons receive on their way from the last scattering surface to us. About 5% of photons scatter from hot gas on the way, that 5% having itself an uncertainty of about 13% just now. The spectral index measures a property of density perturbations that they change with scale, and it is now known that density perturbations on the largest scales are a bit bigger than those on the shortest scales. The spectral index is a little bit less than unity in the normal dimension. And that deviation is measured also quite accurately now. So while Martin Rees and Michael Rowan Robinson only mentioned the density perturbation amplitude, we now actually have two parameters that tell us the shape of initial density perturbations in the universe. So better get a move on, I think. Those are the parameters that we've got. This brief summary, many of you who've been to my talks have seen these two slides before, are to say that observational cosmology is a fantastic success where we've measured lots of things with very, very high precision. And the complementary slide says that the status of theoretical cosmology, and I am unfortunately a theoretical cosmologist, is pretty rubbish because we can't explain any of these numbers to any kind of degree of precision. We don't know a fundamental explanation of any of the main quantities of the universe, despite the extreme accuracy with which they've been measured. So cosmology, to my mind, is in a position where observation is enormously ahead of theory. And that's something which is important for what I'm about to say. So back to this slide again, just to highlight the point. We've measured six things, several of them to percent level accuracy and the other two things to 10% level accuracy. And you would think that that would be very good, that you ought to have learned quite a lot from doing that. But the reality is we've not learned very much at all, because the theoretical equivalents, our predictability for these things, is almost absent. So the baryon density is supposed to emerge from a theory called baryogenesis, which somehow annihilates baryons and antibaryons and leaves something left over. We know what the answer is. It's 1 part in 10 to the 9. But even though we know the answer, there are no compelling theories at all. And the many non-compelling theories give answers which vary by many orders of magnitude, potentially encompassing 10 to the minus 9, but with absolutely no predictive power, even in the exponent, far less than the value itself. Cold dark matter density is not predicted from any fundamental principle because, of course, we don't know what the cold dark matter is. We can't even be certain that it is a particle dark matter or whether it's some kind of primordial black hole or something like that. So completely unknown. Only the more astrophysical things are actually reasonably predictable, like this optical depth is predictable probably to within a factor of 2 by estimating the energy emission from stars and galaxies. The spectral index of density perturbations is not predicted by inflation, but it's certainly plausibly explained as a consequence of models of inflation that generate the primordial density perturbations. But otherwise, the story here is one of very accurate observations not being exploited by equivalently accurate theory. So I wanted to pause for a bit and just ask, well, what would be... Rob.
I just wonder, when you say we don't really know, I mean, don't we have good constraints on what things like cold, dark matter is not? Or would you not even say that? I thought we had better confidence in what it isn't.
I'm sure there are things which are ruled out by observations, for sure, like axions in certain mass windows or high levels of interactions and things. But I don't think, if someone asked you to predict the density of cold dark matter in the universe from first principles, I don't think you have no basis to do that at the moment.
But certain things have been falsified or very tightly constrained.
Yeah. I mean, I think for dark matter, the only way out really is for someone to detect the thing in the lab and then have some measured properties that would allow a prediction. If someone found a supersymmetric particle and measured its cross-section, then you can do the same sort of calculation you do in nucleosynthesis and predict its density. And if it happened to be 0.3 of a critical density, you'd be pretty happy, I think.
What after 40 years of dark matter particles are not detected?
Then, I don't know. Different people have different opinions.
Well,
let me say it first.
Gravity is modified.
Gravity could be modified, as you personally favor. I would say, my personal view is that I used to think that dark matter was overwhelmingly likely to be correct, and every passing day of non-detection of dark matter makes me feel less secure in that belief. Because I'm a Bayesian kind of person, and every time you fail to detect something, it makes that something a bit less likely. I haven't reached a point where I think that dark matter is implausible. Maybe my lifetime isn't long enough for me to reach that point, but the human civilization is potentially going to be long-lived enough to reach that point. Yeah, I completely agree. So, I briefly want to say, what would make a satisfactory theoretical explanation? I've been bemoaning that we don't have one. Another way of saying that is that we have really good theory and really good observations that have given rise to a very precise, accurate, calculable model, which is phenomenological rather than fundamental. That's where we stand today. What would turn it into a fundamental model? Well, normally in physics, what you're supposed to do is think of a bunch of principles that tell you how the universe operates, whose consequences you can develop and match what's observed. What kind of principles might we use that we would think would be fundamental? Well, different kinds of fundamental physics are believed by different people. Certainly for 100 years or more, the dominant ideas in theoretical physics have been that symmetries play a fundamental role, possibly within just quantum field theory, but perhaps the quantum field theory being embedded in some much more sophisticated or abstract structure, such as superstring theory or M theory or any number of these things. But some collection of symmetries would be the guiding principles, if you like. And that's how particle physics is built up. It's how the standard model's created. How would this work in cosmology? Cosmology's ambitions are not so great because we can't measure so many things. I would say almost certainly the best you could hope for as a fundamental description of cosmology is to write down a low-energy effective field theory action. It might be that some signatures of extended objects or extra dimensions are visible in the data. I see no obligation for that to be the case, because all of cosmology happens in a weakly coupled regime. The density perturbations are only 1 part in 10 to the 5, meaning that whatever mass scale is responsible for them is much, much smaller than the Planck scale in order to generate that dimensionless number. So almost certainly we're in a regime where effective field theory approaches are quite good. So I would say that most likely a fundamental description that would satisfy cosmologists would be based on some kind of low energy effective field theory action. And the thing that would make us feel good about it is if that action could be somehow connected to other parts of physics. The real problem with cosmology as it's modeled these days is it largely sits beside standard fundamental physics. It's not part of it. you don't try to simultaneously explain. And some people do. It's not been compelling so far. Sometimes people produce models that are supposed to explain lots of different things simultaneously. Most cosmologists don't. If you work on inflation, you just write down an action that only describes the inflation sector and you pretend everything else doesn't exist. Ideally, we'd like to bind these things together. It ought to include the standard model of particle physics and perhaps some way of extending the standard model of particle physics in either direction in energy space.
I mean, arguably, if you could get there, that would still not be very compelling because you'd still have the question of initial conditions. So you need an addition to the dynamics. You need some understanding of the possibilities of those dynamics. Yeah.
I agree, even if you reached here, and I'm not going to advocate we're going to even reach here, so I'm not even going to address that question, but yes, I would say absolutely you're right. Okay, theoretical explanation. I just want to end that by mentioning that I think there are three different ways that that could go. Option one is that if you manage to think of some fundamental principles and symmetries that are so powerful and so compelling that you're forced to a unique consistent description, which turns out to be compatible with everything we know about the universe. Extraordinarily, that was exactly the prevailing view when I was starting out in cosmology. There was a thing called the first superstring revolution when Green Schwarz discovered the anomaly cancellation that led to the 26-dimensional models with only two possible choices of gauge group. And the sense at the time was very much that a unique fundamental theory might be just around the corner. It might be discovered any day now that the end of theoretical physics was in sight. All I can comment is that it wasn't. But I do feel people genuinely believe that that might have been the case at that time. It's probably very hard to find anyone who believes that now, but maybe not impossible. That it's round the corner, not that it is in principle achievable. Option two seems to me a more plausible way in which this might work out, which is that there could be several consistent descriptions of the cosmological data we have. Now, our information is pretty good, but it's also very limited. If you go to the archive and look at all the theory effort people have been putting in, the amount of theory effort is absolutely colossal to try and explain what at the end of the day is just six numbers. And a natural consequence of that is that there are likely to be several consistent descriptions compatible with any data. So an equivalent question you might like to think about would be this. This more or less corresponds to this. Why does our solar system have eight planets? A plausible answer would be the following. Solar systems tend to have a few planets, so eight's as reasonable a number as any. Ours just happens to have eight. You don't try and explain eight from first principles. I don't think anyone does. You just think, well, 8, 7, 4, 12, they're all plausible. 187's not plausible, maybe. I don't know. That's the kind of outcome we would have, that kind of answer. Now, that seems to me fairly inevitable because the literature is full of different theoretical models that predict identical observational outcomes. For example, as far as cosmology is concerned, any cold dark matter candidate gives exactly the same predicted outcome, whether it's primordial black holes or axions or WIMPs or super heavy WIMPzillas or anything at all. They're observationally indistinguishable, so if you decide that it's cold dark matter, you have no way of telling them apart, at least from cosmology alone. I work a lot on inflation, and I'm equally familiar there that you're predicting essentially one number, the spectral index of density perturbations. Whatever that number is observed to be, there are any number of inflation models capable of producing that number, and there are different mechanisms like curvitons, et cetera, that can give the same observational outcome. So most likely we will be left with several or many consistent descriptions, one of which is presumably true, but we have no observational way of telling between them. It may be worse than that in that it may be that the answers to some questions turn out to be probability distributions rather than actual numbers anyway. I think this is probably an example of that. Your best hope would be to predict some probability distribution for the number of planets in solar systems around stars like the sun and to hope that eight is consistent with being a reasonable realization of that probability distribution. Option three, the last of the options, is that there might be so many consistent descriptions that you despair and decide you have to try and bring in some additional considerations to try and navigate yourself around that. And here is an archetypal example, again, from the solar system that you might or might not believe. Why is our moon proportionally so large? you might decide in the vein of option two to say, well, moons come in all sizes and ours just happens to be large. Or you might try a higher level explanation like this one, which is that the existence of very large moons stabilize rotation axes of planets, which means long-term climate stability is assured, which means life's more likely to arise. Therefore, if life has arisen, it is more likely to be on a planet with a large moon than on a planet with a small moon. Plausible enough, I think. If you're nodding encouragingly, you've just accepted an anthropic principle kind of argument, but that, because that's very much what that is. This may be what's going on in the modern incarnation of superstring theory, where instead of having a single unique theory of nature, you instead have at least 10 to the 500 single, but 10 to 500 non-unique possible vacuum states, and no way of being sure which, if any, of these vacuum states we might end up in. So a very large number of possible universes that might just exist in some kind of space of possible states, one of which has been chosen, or which might exist in some larger meta-universe where different regions of the universe have the properties according to different vacuum states. If you were given that situation, you might find that you wanted to use some additional consideration like this one to try and help navigate around that large space of possibilities. And I am moderately sympathetic to this. Certainly, the only reasonable explanation I've ever seen for the magnitude of the cosmological constant is an argument of this kind made by Steven Weinberg that says that for life to exist, the cosmological constant has to be very small compared to its natural value. And ta-da, it is very small. And we are life. Therefore, that's not implausible at all. OK. I better zoom because time's almost out. So I'm probably only going to say about half of what I wanted to do, but I wanted to say something about the unnerving stability of the standard cosmological model. This is, again, historical perspective. Ofer Lahav's a colleague in University College London, and a long time ago, him and I were asked to write an article for this thing, the Review of Particle Physics, or the Particle Data Group. It's this Bible that every 2 years is published that lists all the masses and interaction rates of every particle you could ever think of, et cetera, et cetera. But since around 2000, it's included various review summaries, including one on cosmological topics. And there's now about 10 review articles on different aspects of cosmology. And Ofer and I write the one on cosmological parameters. So we've now written this 9 times since 2003. And the nice thing about this is that it's a sequence of articles which are all by the same authors. And they cover exactly the period from the WMAP first year release to the final Planck release. So the entire era of precision cosmology. Now, this is how things have changed. I have to look at this table relatively closely to see what's going on. These are the same 6 parameters. The main thing to notice, first of all, is that the uncertainties have typically reduced by about a factor of 10. This is the actual factor written here to guide the eye, but you can see in many of them it's about a factor of 10. Here it's precisely 10. So Planck is, for each parameter, is approximately 10 times better than WMAP. It's a very substantial improvement, and I think more of an improvement than it's given credit for. The collective improvement of the reduction in the parameter space volume is a factor of 10 to the 5 between WMAP and Planck. It's a very great number indeed. So that's important to know. Planck is very much better than WMAP. On the other hand, this is what happens to the central value from 2003 to 2019. This is the shift that it's undergone from WMAP to Planck in units of the WMAP sigma. And what you see is none of them have moved even as much as 2 sigma. So what this first of all tells is that WMAP did a fantastic job. The result was absolutely robust. There's been no big blunder where things have moved around. Even though the first year data wasn't great, you know, they overestimated the optical depth quite considerably, for example, but they had a big error bar, so it's okay. So really, there's been very little change. You know, improvement in accuracy, the uncertainty shifted along a digit, but the values are compatible with what WMAP told us. And because of that, almost 20 years of articles has hardly changed the content. Every year we go along and we change the detail of the table. We change WMAP to Planck and 3-year to 5-year. But the article is almost unchanged. So the 21st century arc of cosmology is to hardly move at all. despite this 10 to the 5, I just want to try and visually represent 10 to the 5 is a lot. This doesn't even quite work, but it's something like that from W map to Planck. If I represent it in two dimensions, it's an uncertainty of the size of the whole slide going down to some microscopic uncertainty here. Why don't you hear more about it? Well, the reason is because observation, even at W map precision, was massively ahead of theory in our ability to predict anything. So another 10 to the 5 improvement in observational accuracy with Planck has not given any significant additional theoretical understanding, which is pretty disappointing, but that's how it is, and I've just said it bluntly. Okay, I sense I've run out of time, so I'm not going to have time to talk about this Russian anarchist of the 1850s, Mikhail Bakunin, who said this very nice phrase: the urge to destroy is also a creative urge, which we should all bear in mind. The reason I became familiar with it is many of you may be familiar with the street artist called Banksy, who auctioned a work called Girl with Balloon in 2018, but had arranged for it to self-destruct as soon as someone bid $1 million, which they did. And it then the painting fell through a shredder, which however jammed halfway like this. And he said, Banksy, the urge to destroy is also a creative urge, quoting Bakunin, so that the quote became wider known at that point. I think I might just actually end with this quote and saying why I put it there and what it's supposed to mean, because it's to urge particularly the young cosmologists. We have competing goals in cosmology, I think, and if you're, depending where you are in your career, these goals might be in some level of tension. Of course, the reason why we do cosmology is we want to understand things. So I think when I'm working on cosmology, my goal is to produce a model. And I like the idea that maybe in 200 years or 2,000 years or 2 million years, someone wants to know how to understand the universe can still use the same model because it's the same universe. Could we be setting down things which are going to remain true forever? Like most of the canon of physics contains things which will be true forever. And I think cosmology should not be afraid to think in those terms. So we want to create something. That's what cosmology is about. That's what the community of cosmology wants to do. But if you're an individual cosmologist or physicist, but particularly I'm talking to cosmologists, you want to do the opposite. You want to destroy the standard cosmology. You want to find ways that it doesn't work. You want to break it. You want to find new physics. You want to undermine it. You want to change it in some way. And the true creativity of cosmology really lies in the act of destruction. You want to find the weak points and take it apart, to challenge it, to see your way to break it into parts. And so the tension is between the urge to create and the urge to destroy. And what cosmology needs, I think, at the moment is a little bit of destruction. And I'm going to end on that note, I think. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll take questions in one moment. But first, let me just mention that tonight we'll be taking Andrew to dinner here in the bistro at 6. And so, you know, tall people should feel welcome. So first, let's start with questions from students. Any student questions? Okay, if not, we'll open up to everyone. First, let's start with Rob.
Thanks for a nice review of the state of the art. That's very informative. I want to ask a question about the degree to which we should be impressed by the fit of this model to the CMB curve that was discovered experimentally. Is there some quantitative measure of the sort of ease of falsifying that model? That strikes me as like I should be impressed to the extent that it would have been easy to falsify. So what I mean is if I give you sort of an arbitrary curve that let's say it starts out similarly and ends similarly, but the wiggles are in different places, it's still smooth,
yeah. But
you know the size of the wiggles are different. Would I not be able to fit that with the
model? You would typically not be able to fit it. There, in detail, the predictions of the structure of the wiggly line are quite precise. In particular, the horizontal locations of the peaks are fixed by the fundamental physics and also by the assumption of the geometry of the universe that it's flat. But the ratio of their locations is fixed. the relative heights of them as a consequence of the way that sound waves propagate under gravitational collapse around the time of recombination. Everything is a consequence of atomic physics being correct, about general relativity being correct. And that greatly ties down the number of forms that that curve can have. So I think you should be impressed, and it is extraordinary. And anyone who says that you could fit any data at all is completely incorrect. It is very, very hard to fit any kind of arbitrary piece of data.
So if I had a program that just varied those six parameters and looked at how the curve changed, in what ways would it change if the particular aspects you're describing?
You would particularly, so let me see if I can find the actual picture just to, so some people do, and the curve's always being computed. Where has it gone?
Up.
The curve's computed numerically, typically by code. So a bunch of people just treat that as a black box. But there are people who earlier used to make a living out of trying to show what the different physical effects were for this. So the geometry of the universe, whether the universe is flat, open, or curved, slides the whole thing left or right. It changes the equivalent angle for a given distance. So the whole thing just slides one way or the other. If you change the density of the baryons in the universe, then the odd-numbered peaks go up and the even-numbered peaks go down. And the ones that go up in proportion. They go down in particular proportion. If I change the amplitude of perturbations, the whole thing goes up. If I change the slope of the perturbations, the whole thing gets tilted. Those are the kinds of changes. If I change the optical depth, it doesn't affect the larger scales and it suppresses the smaller scales. So each of the parameters has a distinctive effect that can be understood from relatively simple physics. But to make a prediction at the sub-percent level accuracy to compare with the data, which is definitely at that accuracy, a full numerical calculation of what the anisotropies look like is necessary. The equations are a bit nasty because it's coupled radiation photon fluid moving in general relativity, but within linear perturbation theory.
Looking back at the history of astronomy, Ptolemaic astronomy lasted from AD 450 up to the 16th and 17th century with the onset of Kepler, Newton. The destruction of this accurate astronomy was due to small effects detected by Tycho Brahe, he describes. These discrepancies led to the elliptical orbits and so on of Kepler and Newton's law. So my question is, these tensions have been published recently, the claimed tensions of the standard model. Do you think they could lead to such a different revolution in the change of the model?
I tend to think no. I'm going to cheekily answer your question by sneaking in an extra couple of slides I didn't manage to talk about, just to abuse my position here. So you mentioned epochs, and one of my working titles for this talk was The Short Cosmological Century, 1915 to 2003. The reason for the phrase, if people who know have studied some history might know this guy, Eric Hobsbawm, is a very famous historian, also a Marxist, so I'm doing well with Marxists today. And he invented a thing called the short 20th century in a landmark book called The Age of Extremes. And the short 20th century ran from 1914 to 1991, from the start of the Second World War to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the gist of his argument was that you shouldn't define centuries by actual numbers, you should define them by events, and that these events were of such colossal magnitude that it makes no sense to try and compare 1907 to 1917. You should use the natural boundaries of history. So in that flavor, I thought of the short cosmological century as lasting from 1915 to 2003. It starts with the invention of GR, which makes cosmology possible, by Einstein, and possibly ends with the production of precision cosmology by WMAP in 2003. And the challenge for anyone who's working in cosmology is to prove that wrong and show that the cosmological century hasn't ended and is actually still ongoing. because cosmology has had an era of great discoveries, and I thought of some of them. You can just read them off the screen. These are facts which are not absolutely accepted by everyone, but are the dominant paradigm. Some of them are incontrovertible. These are what I would say are the great discoveries of our universe, things that are very unlikely to be overturned, things which are of very fundamental importance. And at the moment they end, at the start of the 2000s, I couldn't think of a great discovery since precision cosmology was set in place that has the level of depth of these great discoveries.
How about the tilt of the primordial spectrum?
I don't see it as being of the level of significance of these, but that would shift it to 2006 rather than 2003. Yeah. So somewhere around there. That was the last parameter to be added to the standard cosmological model. So the challenge for cosmologists is to try and prove that the cosmological century has not ended. So that's the first comment about epochs. The second one, you're asking about Hubble tension, which I happen to also have a slide on as well. Many of us were at the talk with Joe Dunkley earlier. I just have one comment really to make about the Hubble tension and whether it's about new physics and is telling us that our whole model's about to collapse. None of the many parameters people are considering explain this discrepancy. You can't go like to an off-the-shelf list of cosmological parameters and grab one and use it to explain this discrepancy. And Joe explained why this morning for those who were there. But I think a more important point that makes me very much doubt that this discrepancy is real is this one. The CMB is enormously more powerful statistically than the direct measurements of H naught. Remember, the CMB is constraining a whole pile of things, six cosmological parameters, and amongst them is constraining the Hubble constant to a much higher precision than the direct measurements are, as you see by the small error bar up at the top. It seems to me it would be an extraordinary coincidence if there was some new physics that was invisible to the CMB data with all of its power, but yet somehow is miraculously unveiled at 5 sigma when you add in one further but very weak piece of data in the direct measurements. It requires a conspiracy. Now, every time you look at someone trying to explain the Hubble tension, you see that conspiracy in action because they always have to introduce two things. They have to try and unfix the Hubble tension to get the different values, and then they have to do something else to try and repair the CMB. And so they move two things around, and if they're judicious and they've chosen the right things, you can manage to cancel the effect in the CMB, but you're left with an enormous coincidence to have done that. And to me, that's a good reason, without doing any calculation, to doubt that this tension will prove to be real. But I'm perfectly possible I'm wrong. It's just my view. How?
I really enjoyed your framing of the talk, and the end point is nice, which is we should break this. And so I'm curious about where you see the breaking points. What's your opinion?
Gosh, any framing is accidental because I've actually stopped the talk halfway through where I intended to get. The last slide would have looked like this had I got that far. Where are the breaking points? You see, we all know that eventually we're not going to be able to observe anymore. It's the nature of cosmology that you're not an active participant in the experiment. You can only watch and see what's there. And so sometime in the future, the last important observation is going to be made. And we don't know when that will be, but the last thing that tells us something of significance about the universe. We can say for sure that it will happen at some point, and the last thing we can do is when the cosmic variance limit, the statistical uncertainty, becomes large on the very last observational strategy you had. Suppose you've collected every photon and every graviton and every neutrino that comes to the Earth, for example, and analyzed it, then you're certainly beyond that point there. But at some point, the last significant observation will be made. So the challenge to think about is, has that already happened? I have this nagging suspicion that maybe it has. I hope I'm wrong.
I
any more questions, hopefully more optimistic.
This is very optimistic.
You mentioned inflation a few times, and can you comment, maybe also relating a little bit to this, can you comment a bit on the observational status of inflation?
Yes, I can. To my mind, inflation is very unlikely to be overturned as an element of the standard cosmological model. And the reason is because the density perturbations that we see are identified as being of adiabatic form, of being Gaussian or very close to Gaussian in their statistical properties, and most importantly of all, of having existed on superhorizon scales. Again, that lurks somewhere in my list of great discovery that it went almost unexplained. But down at the bottom of this list, it's essentially established that the universe has been perturbed on scales beyond its Hubble radius. And the initial density perturbation spectrum extends to some very large scale, and most of the scales that we look at, we see the sign of that. And the oscillatory structure in the CMB that Rob Speckens was asking about is a consequence of the fact that the perturbations were laid down long before we observed them in the microwave background. And inflation is a very clear explanation for that, which I think is going to be very, very hard to overturn. The trouble is we can't really measure very much about it, and our best hope really in cosmology, we've measured the spectral index to something not quite 10% accuracy, and that tells us something about models of inflation. Everyone wants to measure gravitational waves, primordial tensors, and that would be a second piece of information if it can be done, and that might be possible or it might not. Some models of inflation allow it, many models of inflation do not, so you can't say. Even then, that's two pieces of information. It's hard to see much prospect of going beyond that because attempts to measure things like cosmic non-Gaussianity have failed. Attempts to measure Isaac curvature perturbations have failed. The number of inflation models is enormous. So if you set that against two observed parameters with maybe 10% error bars, you are never going to narrowly pin down the way in which inflation took place. And so I think there again, it's hard to be very optimistic that we're going to uncover anything very novel in the future that restricts the possible phenomenology of inflation. If anything, the danger is that theorists will be clever enough to create even more ways of generating inflation that give the same observational predictions as we already have from other means.
Okay, so final question from Rob.
So I'm still processing your answer to my first question. So this is kind of a follow-up. I mean, you said for example, the relative height of the first peak and the second peak is not sensitive to the choice of the parameters in this model.
The relative heights of the odd peaks versus the even peaks. It's not obvious. I didn't describe the physics of the CMB at all, but the odd peaks correspond to compressions of the fluid, and the even peaks correspond to rarefactions of the fluid. So there's a kind of pattern that if you alter the physics, you normally enhance the compressions and weaken the rarefactions or similar. So you tend to get the odd peaks going up and the even peaks going down or vice versa, more or less in concert.
So maybe I'm misremembering, but when I said how generic could that curve have been, you said, well, there's certain features of this curve that are essentially insensitive to the choice of the values of the parameters.
Right. So
you gave a number of examples.
Yeah, so like it's hard, you couldn't boost the height of the third peak without also altering the first, for example. You can't.
Okay, so if I take the ratio of those heights, okay, so that's going to be something that's relatively insensitive to the choice of the parameters. So my question is, to what extent can we score the quality of the models in terms of what they predicted about those relative heights relative to what the data found concerning those relative heights? So you're saying, you know, the absolute height of each one is something that could vary with parameters, but the relative height is essentially...
Yeah.
So that means the models ought to be making a quantitative prediction about it.
That's right. So I think that the relative height, if you only had two peaks, it's the relative height that contributes mainly to the measurement of the baryon density. So the relative height of two of the peaks is not predicted by the theory. It will determine the baryon density. And then having fixed the baryon density, the relative heights of all the other peaks will follow as a consequence of that.
Okay.
I think Rob asked how, in which sense can you score? Is that what you said? Score.
In which sense can you score is.
So for example, like what you just said suggests to me, all right, take the relative height of the first two peaks. You should with, you know, the relative height of the second and the third. So that's something now that you just said is independent of the parameters. So it is something quantitative that the model predicts, which we can then compare to the data.
Yes, people have certainly done that and the data fits very well, but to I don't immediately see how to translate that into a score. Like if you want an alpha, beta, gamma, you want...
I'm just thinking it might be you know, if you told me if it's a five sigma effect, that's a language in which I could understand how I have to be impressed by the model, because this particular function of the, you know, these peak heights is well predicted by the model, you know, in this sense. I mean, you sort of later focused on how poorly the theory was able to predict these six parameters.
But
you were also emphasizing how impressed we should be by the quality of the model. And so I'm trying to
find a
parameter which the model has done a very good job of predicting.
Evidence.
Yeah, the evidence could be. So I want to just clarify. I think
that we managed to, like, basically what goes into this is that we have an acoustic container with nice boundary condition, and we really tested that with a fluid particular pressure.
And I think, I need to draw kind of a divide. The parameters, the six parameters are phenomenological parameters which are sufficient to allow us to make predictions of the data. And the predictions are in extraordinary agreement with the data, as you see from these residuals here. I don't need any more information than the values of those parameters to make these fantastic predictions. And that's the basis of why people say the standard cosmological model is so successful. The place where we're failing is to retract from those phenomenological parameters to something more fundamental.
So I understood all that, but you know, when I asked if I'd drawn an arbitrary curve, would you have been able to fit it well with those six parameters? Your answer was no.
The answer is no.
Why is it no? You said because there are features of this curve which
are robust under change. Yeah.
And so I say whatever feature you want to focus in on.
Yeah.
Let's take that feature and ask how well
is it fixed? Yeah. That's
to what the experimental data gave us.
Yeah. So. I'm sure the answer is very well, but I just don't know the answer to your question because it's not a calculation I've done. But if you, for example, take all the models which run through the first peak and the first trough, that curve will then be essentially completely determined and will run through all of these peaks and troughs at the level of accuracy of this data, which is percent level or so. To convert that into, so then if you say, well, instead my data could have gone some other distance away that's 10% different from that, then it's 10 sigma. But I don't have any basis for thinking how different could it have been. An example the other way around was that the rival to inflation models, which give this very accurate prediction, was models based on topological defects such as cosmic strings. And their prediction was a single broad peak centered around L of 500. So their theory prediction looked like this. And again, the height of the peak had some dependence on the baryon density, and the horizontal location could be changed by the geometry of the universe. But any curve which is one single fat peak with no amount of tweaking fit this observational data, and it would fail not by five sigma but by
a... won't persuade me that this is a good model, because had the good model been able to...
We should move this downstairs to refresh. So let's thank Andrew again.